Welcome to Service and Wealth, the podcast dedicated to helping military personnel master their finances and achieve financial freedom. Our mission is to guide you through the ins and outs of planning, saving, and investing. And most importantly, how to balance savings so you can enjoy life now and retire with confidence. All right. Well, hey, today we're doing our second interview format for the Service and Wealth podcast, which is part of our reboot for season two. As we're getting going, it's kind of like, you know, reset training, like let's do something to just kind of kick things off and reset our minds and get things going again. And this year we're doing some interviews, and this is just the second one. And I'm really excited because, different from our first guest, who is an old guy like I am, still in, still active duty, our guest on this episode is at the start of her career. I'm really pleased and really excited to have First Lieutenant Anna Saucedo join us. Is it okay if we just call you Anna, or should I call you
Anna's
LT?
Great. No.
So, you know, similar to the first guest, I have the privilege of having known Anna for quite a while. And goes back to when I was at the Naval Academy and she was a midshipman at the academy. Anna's from California. She grew up in Temecula and went to the Naval Academy, where she commissioned in, is it three years ago already?
3 years now, yeah.
Oh my goodness, time flies. Well, yeah, so I guess you're almost getting close to being a senior lieutenant, right? Like, so this will be really good. So she's been a Marine Corps officer for 3 years now, and she's currently in Japan, right? Not Okinawa. You're actually on the mainland.
Yeah,
right?
It is Okinawa.
Okay. You are in Okinawa. Okay. Cause you're on a Mew. So she's floating around the Pacific on a boat as a combat engineer and platoon commander. So hopefully having the time of your life. So without anything further, Anna, welcome to the show. We're really excited to have you on, and just tell us a little bit more right now about like what's going on in your life and what you're doing. And, you know, we don't have to talk straight away into finance stuff.
Awesome. Yeah. So I'm out here with the 31st Mew. It's funny they call it a deployment because there are people that live out here in Okinawa, Japan. So it's not very far removed from American culture. I'm still very much, I could go get Pizza Hut like 5 minute walk from here. So
yeah,
Okinawa is its own beast. It's not real Japan. It's like fake Japan, but it's still definitely an experience being overseas. And then got some liberty in Australia and mainland Japan recently on the Mew. The ship ported in Sydney and Brisbane, and then hopped on a different boat and we went up to Sasebo. So that was really
excellent.
Awesome. Yeah. If you don't know where Temecula is from geographically in the United States, it's close to San Diego. So grew up in Southern California. Picked up snorkeling out here recently. So I love all things outdoors.
Cool.
I don't know if you mentioned it earlier, but when we were at the Timelines matchup at the academy, you rode with us on the cycling team, and that's where I picked up the sport of cycling. So definitely fell in love with sport of cycling in college, and then that remains with me to this day. I rode a lot at my home station in Pendleton, and then got a bike out here, just a cheap one to use to scratch the itch. I love all things two wheels. Recently got into motorcycling as well, and then
done a fair bit of
rock climbing out here. So having a good time.
Cool.
Having a good time. Yeah.
I've heard great things about the bouldering in Okinawa.
Yeah. So I actually went outdoors recently. I have a buddy of mine teaching me some of the more technical things about outdoor rock climbing, but climbing in a gym is a lot of fun. But then when you get outside, it's a very different sport. It's similar to riding a stationary bike. You can build up your strength indoors, but then when you get outside and do the real thing, you notice it's very, very different.
Yeah. Yeah. I still think back to the first time that I touched like real rock, and I was like, where are the holds? And
yeah,
like,
and exactly.
The holds go in. You're like, oh
exactly.
My gosh.
Yeah.
They don't feel the same. They're not all like scratchy and easy to grab onto.
Yeah. Or you have to look for them. In a gym, it's very much like, that's what I need to grab as my next thing. And then you get outside and you're like, whoa, where do I put my hands and feet?
It's all gray and brown.
Yeah.
Wow. That's neat. And so I've been to Okinawa. When I was there, I was over task saturated, so I didn't get to get out and experience things. But I've heard that not only is the bouldering great, but that like there's tremendous snorkeling and diving around Okinawa.
Yes.
So it's not like you had to like wait and go someplace. It's all in your backyard for the time
yeah,
being.
It really is. And unfortunately, I didn't dabble into it until after the float. But if any service members listening to this are headed to Okinawa, you might hear bad things. But if you're even hesitant, maybe you don't like swimming, just try snorkeling at least. Like, less than waist deep, you stick your face in the water and there's like tropical fish and coral reefs. So it's really, really awesome. I wish I started it sooner when I was out here, but just the op tempo didn't really allow. And then we're leaving here pretty soon. So if you're interested, try snorkeling. And then the diving is awesome. I'm not dive certified, but a lot of my buddies did that, got their dive certification out here. It's significantly cheaper than in the U.S. And then it can use it all around the world. Like some of my friends went diving in the Great Barrier Reef when we ported for just 3 days. So if that's a hobby, definitely something to try in Okinawa.
Yeah, that's all really great advice, right? Because you can so easily get kind of sucked into the op tempo and the battle rhythm and thinking like, I gotta, you know, I think back to when I was at the same point in my career as you are, and we had like this competition of like, amongst all the first lieutenants, it was like, if you were the last one in or the first one to leave, you were considered a dirt bag. And it was, you know, this competition. And then it just so happened that the dirt baggiest of them all was this Mustang who was great at his job, but he was wise enough to know, like, there's other things in life to do and, you know, to fit those things in. And so to hear you doing it is really motivating. And I hope it's inspiring for those who come after you and they don't get bogged down in the suck and the work and all that stuff.
Exactly. Yeah. And so I think the officer side of that is like, oh, you're busy, you're doing work, you're being productive. But the enlisted Marine side of that is like not having the means to go do those things. So if they don't have cars, they think they just have to sit in their barracks rooms and drink. But there's always opportunities. Like there is public transportation out here. So if they see you doing cool things or they get the resources from you to do those cool things, it's just enabling to let them have those fun adventures out here too.
That's a fine bit of leadership and mentorship, right? You know, it's you may think of leadership as only what's happening, you know, on base or on the ship in uniform, but you're leading all the time when you're a commissioned officer. And not just a commissioned officer, right? Like our NCOs are also given the same kind of like expectation and reality. But I really respect the way that you just and appreciate what you just pointed out, that like they're not just looking at you in uniform. It's all the time.
Yeah. Yeah. So I've become a little bit more comfortable with that out here. Just at least like I teased my platoon guide. He was like, oh, I'm scared of heights. And I was like, just come rock climbing, come try it. It's not that far. Like you just go up, you might fall like 2 meters. You'll be fine. He bought a pair of shoes recently. Like he's been 2 or 3 times now on his own. So we dragged him out. We got him out of the bricks. We were like, come on, come do it. Come try it. And now he loves it. So it's just
excellent.
Getting him out there to try it.
Pretty soon you'll have the whole platoon out there at the slab just like taking over.
I got to get them all on bikes. And when we get to Pendleton, I got to rent bikes and there's a bunch of trails. And yeah, I got to get them out there.
Well, this has been great. And, you know, I think it's not just you and I just kind of catching up a little bit after you've been off in the fleet doing great things. But I feel like we've already covered some really valuable things for the audience. And today, what we really wanted to do is take advantage of the fact that we have this first lieutenant 3 years into her military career, who's really in the thick of not just the transition from like into having, you know, a steady paycheck into getting BAH into like the whole world of military pay and entitlements. But at the same time, she's deploying, she's going overseas, she's coming in and out of, you know, internet access and all the things that we take for granted. And so she's like right in the thick of it right now in terms of managing her finances, figuring out what she's doing, learning about her different entitlements and pay and benefits and all those things. And she's also obviously managing some expensive hobbies like like bikes and snorkeling and things like that. So I'm really excited to just kind of like hear from her what the reality is on the ground, right? For someone in their mid-20s. I think, you know, we kind of got your story, your lead in here to how you ended up in a barracks room on Okinawa as a first lieutenant in the Marine Corps. I also want to ask just sort of like, so that when you share some of your other observations from being here in the fleet or like finances when you're at the academy as a midshipman, just to kind of understand like, you know, the way you see things and why you're thinking things, maybe you could just kind of give us a little bit of your money story. You know, for example, like growing up, did you have conversations? Did you have a job when you're young? Did you have allowances? Like just sort of like where your background is with money and finance.
Yeah. So growing up in Temecula, it's a pretty nice area. There's nobody, like, you're not going to go get shot outside. There's a couple sketchy parts up the highway a little bit, Hemet and stuff, but Temecula's fairly nice. Some of my friends, even in high school, were like, oh yeah, I'm going to work on the vineyard this weekend. I'm like, oh my gosh, like, these people own big mansions out in the, and I've gone bike rides and runs out there. Like, there are some very well-off people in Temecula. So I grew up, like, I would say middle of the pack, like, never had to worry about where my meals were coming from and had a roof over my head. So for that, I'm really thankful. But I did grow up with divorced parents. So I did hear a lot of money conversation, like child support. My dad's working full time, but not seeing us and sending money back to my mom. My mom's also working full time. So money was definitely like a stressor in the family, but never to the point mm-hmm. where, like I said, I'm worried about getting fed or a place to sleep. And then I think it definitely swayed me in high school. I did, looking back, I was interested in, like, there was a mountain biking team, but that was like, well, I can't afford a mountain bike, and that's not something I'm going to be able to drive to practice out at Vail Lake or anything like that. So I never got into some of the things I would have liked to in high school just because of money. I just ended up running cross country because it was one of the cheaper things to do. All you need is a pair of shoes.
It's about as cheap as it gets.
Exactly. So did that, and really thankful for that. It gave me some of the friends I still talk to this day, and really helped me with spatial awareness, actually, just running and memorizing streets and stuff. So
sure.
Have that to look back on fondly. But that's a little bit about how I view money. Definitely grew up with, like, a frugal mindset. And definitely just, like, learned a lot of, like, my mom shopped with coupons and stuff. So that's just mm-hmm. the kind of household I grew up in. And that's sort of the method I adopted and still sort of how I live to this day. I think something that really captures my experience that I didn't realize until I went to college was the fact that I didn't have a car in high school. A car was, like, I was told by my mom, and I saw my brother do it. He worked at Domino's and he saved up enough money to get a car. But when I was in high school, I was in pursuit of getting into college towards the later years, and I was just always involved in clubs and stuff. So I was told, if you want a car, you're buying your own. Like, my car is my car that I need to get to work.
Right.
So I was like, well, that's not going to happen because I don't have time for a job. I'm too busy and all these clubs and extracurriculars I do. So luckily I lived within walking distance to school. So I usually walked. In middle school, actually, I had a not so great bicycle that I rode. So I got around how I needed to, but didn't actually work anything on paper until getting into the Department of Defense. So my first, like, paycheck on paper came from the military, and my siblings tease me about that all the time because they're like, you've never worked an actual job. And I'm like, well, but I did do some gigs, like some side work with a photography company in high school. Like, on the weekends I would go pose little kids with a soccer ball and snap a camera and walk away with $500 bucks. So,
which is, I mean, that like is that. More like what work is today anyway, right? Like, we're now in the gig economy. Everybody's got their side hustle, cash economy. So you actually were ahead of your time in the way that you were earning some cash.
Yeah. So worked some weekends, but didn't even get my driver's license until I went home during COVID in college. I wasn't the only one. Like, at the Naval Academy, there are a fair amount of people that just didn't get the chance to get a license in high school, but I was definitely the minority and got teased a fair bit for it.
So un-American of you not to have a car for your 16th birthday, right?
Exactly. Yeah, no. That's... No, I watched my friends get like, oh, my parents bought me this car. And I'm like, oh, wow, that's, we're living in different worlds here.
Right. Well, you know, I feel like there's kind of two important, like, phases or, like, factors influencing probably your view of money and finances. And on the one hand, the way that your mom was kind of like, if you want this, like, earn it. And that's, like, a really great lesson. And probably set you up for responsibility going forward, as opposed to, like, if you just were given a car and then it breaks and they pay for it, like, you never have that accountability. And at the same time, you mentioned at the outset of this that there was a lot of stress about finance.
Yeah.
And maybe you could go a little bit more in saying, I guess, how you feel about money, like, based on that. Did it paint, like, your emotional response to money? Are you, like, somebody who's an avoider? I think you mentioned you're frugal, so maybe that just turned you into, like, somebody who's, like, pinching every pennies. But, like, how do you see, like, that early experience kind of influencing you?
Yeah, so it's less of a stressor now. Like, in high school, if it was, oh, we need, everybody in the class needs to pay for this, that, and the other, it's like, I don't know if I'm going to be able to do that. Like, a teacher always, like, come to me if it's something you can't afford. So then have to either go talk to parents and then see if it's something we could pay for. But yeah, definitely a stressor in high school or growing up, but less so now. I think it's just made me more of a thrifty person now. Like, I do it for fun, not really because I need to, but I'm just, my brain is wired to work that way. Like, how can I save? And now I use that money to invest, and less so forceful saving. Back then it was like I said, stressful and elicits emotions, but now it's like I do it because it's just part of who I am now.
Well, I think it's turned out to be a really positive, because it could have gone another way, you know. And when you study the way that early experiences with money and like psychology can work, is I think for you it was going to go one or two ways, where you kind of became this like saver, or you could have been an avoider. And like an avoider is somebody who only associates stress with money. And their response is they bury their head in the sand. They don't educate themselves about it. And then one day they wake up, you know, and they're like six figures in debt, right? And they're in severe, severe difficulty. So do you think that was there something special about you, or were you just like really pragmatic that you were like, okay, I see that this is stressful. Like I don't want it to be stressful for me. So I'm going to take control of it. I'm going to be in charge. Or, you know, maybe you're just somebody who's kind of like very organized by default.
Yeah, more so now, just because I'm a semi-organized individual. And then I think just the problem solving in me sees it as a problem to be solved, a tool that everybody uses. And so I studied operations research at the Naval Academy, and that's very much like very applied math and logistics and problem solving and optimization of time, people, resources, money. So it's sort of just the way my brain's wired at this point, but less emotions involved in it.
And how would you say overall that this is working out for you, given your current situation? Do you feel like after 3 years of real job, real paycheck, do you feel like you're in control, that you're headed down the right path? Or do you feel like there's, you know, things are still chaotic? Like, where are you right now in a big picture?
Yeah, so not chaotic. And maybe I could tie in a little more emotion, because now it's, I have the money, and so I'm going to do it because I can. So maybe sometimes some of my big purchases should stress me out a little bit more than they do. For example, a couple months before deploying, I bought a motorcycle. That's a significant amount of money to just put down. But I'm like, oh, I can afford it right now. It's something I want to do. I didn't buy a brand new one. I bought a used one and had a buddy help me shop for it, because it's something I could afford and something I saw as a hobby I wanted to pick up, a way to save gas commuting. It's something I pulled the trigger on and don't regret one bit. Absolutely love it. But to your point, I think I could be tying in a little bit more of, maybe some of those big purchases should make me a little bit more worried than they do. But because that's the way I grew up, I just don't think like that anymore. It's like, well, now I can afford it, so I'm going to do it.
Okay. All right. You know, I think that's actually like a good little case to talk a little bit more about, because when you say I can afford it to people, that can mean a lot of things. So maybe you could tell us a little bit more about, like, did you finance it? You know, do you put a down payment and then a loan? Did you pay cash?
Like, no, I paid cash, but I bargained a little bit for it. So I had a buddy that I was working with, and he rode his motorcycle to work, and I had always wanted to. So I started picking his brain about it, and he was a huge advocate for it. He's like, yeah, I can totally teach you how to ride. I can help you shop. I know a good bit of mechanics. He's also an Academy grad, so I trusted him there, bonded over that a little bit, trauma bonding. But I'm pretty good about not just pulling the trigger. I like to do my research. So I got on Cycle Trade is a big website in Southern California where people can post used motorcycles. Always been a proponent for buying used. And then I looked on OfferUp, looking at used motorcycles. For me, I didn't want to get something super used because it comes with a lot of unknowns. But found something. First owner, like, he bought it brand new from the dealership. It was actually an Italian dude who's like, yeah, I'm leaving the States. I'm going back to Italy. I need it sold. And so I kind of lowballed him. It was a really nice bike, 2023. I kind of lowballed him, and he's like, no, I can't pay that. And then I was like, well, I'm going to let it sit. And he came back to me. He messaged me 2 weeks later and was like, oh, I still need it gone. How about that offer? And so
nice.
I just let it marinate, and then I bought it in cash. So I had to go to the bank a couple times to pull out chunks of $500, because they can't give you like $4,500 at once. I learned that. Right. I didn't know that. But I had the money, and it was sitting in savings. And I have pretty long commute in Pendleton, and gas is super expensive. So I did the math on it. I actually made a whole spreadsheet. I was putting $100 into my tank every week. And I'm like, this thing's going to pay for itself, given enough time. And I enjoy doing it. It's a lot of fun. It's safe. I took the courses. The military will offer you free riding courses that cost upwards of $400 in the civilian world. So learned how to ride before I even got the bike. Got the bike. Again, just negotiating skills, and the dude needed it gone. So had a buddy that helped me and taught me, and then ended up purchasing. The bike retailed for like $7,000 or $8,000, but he was the first owner, and then I lowballed him for $4,500, and so I bought a once used bike for $4,500, and I loved it. I loved every second of it. So I think that was just the cyclist in me. Like the first time I went up a hill, and all I had to do was twist my right wrist and fly uphill. That was incredible. And then I'm smiling ear to ear under my helmet every time I ride. So to me, it was absolutely worth it.
Well, that's great. You know, and it's part of sort of the whole philosophy that we try to preach and promote with the Military Wealth Coach and the Service and Wealth Podcast, is that like when you're smart about money and you're educated about your finances and you're organized and you're in control and you have a budget set up and you have savings set aside, like you can have fun. Most people think like putting yourself on a budget and it's just about saying no to everything. But this is an example of like pretty significant purchase. You know, $4,500 cash is nothing to laugh at, you know, at any rank or age, right? You clearly did your diligence. And also, I just get the sense that over the next few years, you are going to do like big things when it comes to real estate and investment, because if you can sniff out a desperate, you know, seller and then just be patient and make them come to you. Like you got some skills there.
Yeah. So again, the motorcycle community was new to me. So I had my buddy whispering in my ear and he was like, just offer this and see what he says. Because I didn't know like what would be reasonable, what would be a low ball. It was totally a low ball. But he came back to me and the bike had a bunch of bells and whistles he added. He was also a cyclist. So he's packing up his garage for Italy when I show up, and he gave me like two sets of road bike wheels. Those are probably, I mean, you know, those are like $200 alone. To me, those were gold. He's like, do you want to take any of this? And I was like, yeah, absolutely. So yeah, definitely found a good deal there.
Well, good. And you know,
yeah,
the other part, and I think this is what, you know, the big thing that tricks or trips up, especially young service members, but like everybody, like 90% of Americans, is when they can buy a vehicle with a low down payment, they mistake that for affording it, right? And then they inherit. I think the average car payment for a new car right now in America is like close to $900 a month. And the average payment for a used car loan is over $600 a month. If you had gone that route and you instead, you know, like bought a Tacoma, like every other lieutenant in Pendleton has a Tacoma, you know, and you inherited like a $700 or $800 a month auto loan payment, would you still be thinking like, oh, I can afford this? Or how would that have affected your finances?
No. Yeah. So the only monthly payment I have, I think this is one of your later points to talk about, so we can go into more depth later. But my monthly payment loan related right now is just the Career Starter Loan, which is, I think I have it written down here, but somewhere around $600 a month. But that's a super low interest rate. So that's not a $900 car payment where over 20% of it is just interest going out the window. And yeah, I also bought my car in cash. I don't actually just don't do any of the down payment and then interest rate. I just don't like the idea of racking up interest. I don't think I can afford it if it means putting a down payment and then paying absurd amounts of interest later down the road.
Okay. No, I think that's great. Like, yeah, well, we'll come back to talking a little bit more about the Career Starter, or it's Starter, not Kickstarter. I don't know, whatever, the Career Starter Loan, a little bit more later. But what you just offered up really has me curious about your overall, you know, opinion on things like debt and financing. You know, obviously nobody likes to pay interest. It hurts when you see that statement come in and you're like, wait, that much went to interest? Like, that's not making me progress. But do you have any like deep-seated feelings about debt in general?
Yeah. So, well, I'm learning about it right now because I ended up using the VA loan. So I've taken deep dives into what a mortgage payment actually consists of. And like you said, absolutely shocked looking at how much of it is just interest. The house is like $500,000 in Southern California, townhome. So that's good. But when I look over the 30-year fixed, I'm going to end up paying $1 million for it, which is absolutely wild to me. So looking at the math on that, like, yeah, it definitely makes me uneasy, but that's a price I was willing to pay to get my foot in the door with real estate. So I could, and I have been having conversations with realtors about like, was that worth it? Is it worth it? Should I keep it? Should I sell it? Right now I'm still holding it, just using my BAH for the mortgage payments. But like you said, looking at those payments and how much of it is interest, yeah, definitely a little unsettling. So that's a debt that I take on because I see it as an asset building value. Like Southern California real estate, in my opinion, is it's always going to be there. It's home to me. So having a place there is something I'm willing to keep pouring money into. But the only other debt that I have taken on at this point in time is, yeah, that career starter loan. And that's 0.75. So I actually had a leadership teacher, second class year would be junior year of college. And I like this elicited an emotional response, which is why I remember it. But he says, how many of you guys are taking the career starter loan? And maybe half of us raised our hands. And or maybe he asked who isn't. And they, he asked who isn't. And they raised their hands. And then he was like, you are an idiot. And I'm going to tell you why. And he had a whole like PowerPoint. And to a lot of us that just hadn't researched finances before, like he made some really good points. And he's like, if you just invest like even this fraction of it, you're going to beat out the interest rate that the loan even offers. You're losing money if you don't take it. Your friends at normal universities don't have the opportunity to take out. In fact, you'll never see a loan with this rate ever again. So if you don't take it, you're an idiot. And I was like, well, I was going to take it anyways, but I just watched him like berate all my friends. But I learned something in the process.
Keep so, your head down, right?
Like, oh. Yeah, exactly. I was like, yeah, I knew all that. No, but he definitely had some really good points to make. And that was interesting hearing from a seasoned 05 in the Navy. But yeah, those are the two sources of debt I have right now. And to answer your question, the home debt makes me a little uneasy, but learning about it. And like I said, it's Southern California and it's the place I live right now. So
yeah, that's and so it's a townhouse. It's in Temecula. Is it vacant? Did you move a roommate in? What's
the status? It's in Fallbrook. I was shopping for it while I was on the East Coast, actually, in MOS school.
Okay.
Always had an entrepreneurial mindset and wanted to get the foot in the door with the real estate. So when I found out I was going to Southern California, I knew it was going to be tricky to get the foot in the door there. Because I was talking to a realtor. She also gave me a one-liner that was pretty funny. I didn't have a concept of how much real estate costs there because I watched the house my parents bought for $200,000 in like 2002 is now, if you Zillow it, it's like near $1 million. And so that's absolutely insane to me. But she was like, what's your price range? And I'm like, I don't really know. I'm going to have to see what the VA will allot me. And she's like, well, for reference, $200,000 will get you like a mailbox nowadays. And I'm like, oh my gosh. And I start looking and it's like, yeah, she wasn't kidding. The absolute cheapest thing I could get close to Pendleton is like a really, really run down condo for like $300,000, one bed, one bath. And that doesn't leave me a lot of room for roommates or like it's an old place and I don't want to inherit like an apartment from 1970. So I ended up talking to a realtor, a really good friend of mine, Evan Ortiz, would highly recommend him for Southern California because he's ex-Army. So he's really, really good at utilizing the VA loan and has a military experience in his back pocket. And he helped me shop around a little bit. And we found a new development in Fallbrook, townhome for just under 500,000, two bed, 2.5 bath. And I was able to move into it pretty soon after I moved to California. And then I didn't get a roommate. I just had my little sister live with me. So she didn't, she needed somewhere to live and I wasn't going to charge her for it. So we lived together for about a year and she was able to use that as an opportunity to just get her feet planted a little bit. She was dealing with some medical issues at the time. So I loved living with her and I wouldn't have traded it for the world. Like, yeah, looking back, I could have 100% tried to find a roommate and charge them, but I loved living with her and that was definitely worth it to me. When I deployed, she was on her way out as well. She was moving down south closer to work. So I decided to completely vacate the property, move all my stuff into storage. And then I wasn't comfortable like renting it by myself because I knew I was going to be on a ship without internet. So I ended up hiring a property management company and they got somebody in there within 30 days of me getting out. So I wanted the tenant to sign 6 months, but they ended up signing a year. So I'm going to be homeless when I make it back to California. So that's a later problem for me to figure out. But I do have somebody living there right now. So that's been pretty cool because I've saved saved a nice little bit. I still get paid BAH, and then somebody's paying to live there as well. So definitely been saving.
And how does the rent compare to the cost of ownership? Are they paying basically?
I am absolutely losing money. But I say losing, if I wasn't receiving BAH, I'd be losing money. But to me, they're paying a fraction of the mortgage, just under $500. My mortgage is around $3,500. They're paying $3,000 to live there, which is like they're getting a sweet deal, like all my HOA benefits, and I'm the one paying the HOA. So good for them. But unfortunately, I am losing money in the deal. And I think that's just the way the market is in Southern California right now. My location is not exactly ideal. It's a newer development between two highways that's at least 15 minutes from any grocery store or school. So to even have tenants there, I was happy that somebody signed it instead of the place sitting empty for my deployment. But to answer your question, yeah, I'm losing money. But in the grand scheme of things, it's better than a place being empty, in my opinion.
Yeah. And you made the point several times in that series of comments that for the market for Southern California, finding an entry point that you can afford, both in terms of like the down payment and then the monthly payments for the mortgage. It's, you know, 20 years from now, you're going to look back and let's say that house is worth, if it's the same growth trajectory as the house your parents purchased in 2002, you know, 20 years from now, you'll look back and you're like sitting on $5 or $6 million, you know, townhouse. You're like, wow.
I mean, hopefully it doesn't get that crazy. I would like to think the last 2 decades have been an absurd skyrocket. But if that rate continues, yeah, sure. Maybe we're looking at a $5 or $6 million townhome in 30 years.
Yeah. And, you know, I think any place, this is just a semi quasi political comment, but like in pretty much any other country in the world, the attitude or the perspective on America and American housing market is that we're all insane because we have such an affordability crisis. And yet at the same time, you know, it's all these people who are sitting over here in Europe and they're like, wow, you guys are out of control. But then they won't buy real estate here. They buy it in the U.S. So they're contributing to the run up in property values anyway.
That's funny to hear from an external perspective.
Yeah, it is. And it's I would say it's a really valuable perspective to get, you know, the getting outside of that like little shell to like learn and grow is really important. And so, you know, for you, when you're thinking about where you are and just being, you know, a combat engineer in the Marine Corps at Camp Pendleton, surrounded by military community and, you know, teaching yourself about finance and real estate and all this stuff, like how are you finding it in terms of the kind of information you're getting, the advice? Like what, how people think, like, you know, are you learning things or is it like the kind of group think type approach to things?
Yeah.
I don't know if that question makes sense, but you tell me if it doesn't.
No. Yeah, definitely learning. I think the group think occurs very quickly. And in a group like lieutenants, as you mentioned before with the Toyota Tacoma joke, is like, yeah, a lot of lieutenants, they just, it's their first time having large sums of money and go off buying brand new cars. Or get like a beachfront property as their home when they're paying their entire BAH to go live on the beach. And it's like, if that's your goal, then that's great. But for me, I always knew I wanted to do real estate if possible, or at least some sort of house hack. So even friends that live together and pool together to rent a lieutenant mansion is the term usually used, like just a house in Oceanside that costs probably the entire BAH or slightly over, but you have five people paying it together. And then the lieutenants that are living there are pocketing a bunch of BAH. So yeah, definitely a little bit of groupthink occurs in the housing market. And then to answer the other portion of your question, how I get my information, just books, podcasts. I think you have your book behind you there. So I had that one downloaded on my iPad for the ship and definitely marked it up and annotated it. A lot of actionable things that I unfortunately couldn't action while on ship. Like you had some good information in there that I wanted to make some changes to how I manage my finances, but had to just make some notes and do it later once I could get back on the internet off ship. But I also really like the Bigger Pockets podcast. And then a book that I think I brought it actually. Yeah, I have it here. Set for Life by Scott Trench. That's one of my favorites. I had a friend recommend it to me at my MOS school. He was actually friends with Scott Trench. So he told me all about them growing up in Colorado and stuff together. So really small world, but I get a bunch of my information from podcasts, usually on my commute into work.
Yeah, that's a great way to do it, right? And like, you just can't help but think when you have an hour and a half plus a day that, you know, you have one really important responsibility, which is to like keep yourself alive and not crash. But at the same time, like, that doesn't require your whole brain. And it's a great time to just kind of like invest in yourself and learn. And you know, you put all that under the category of like self-improvement. And in the course of a year, you know, we don't have to necessarily try to do the math, but that's a couple, several hundred hours worth of like learning that you can cram in. So that's great.
Do you want to maybe...
If they're on the top of your mind, like pick a couple of the changes or adjustments that you have in mind that you want to make to the way you're managing your finances. You referenced finding some actionable things in the book. I'm curious to know what those are.
Yeah, I think you had mentioned the emergency funds in like the high yield savings accounts. I really just needed to do a deep dive on where the majority of my money sits. Like, I think my flow path is really bad right now. Like, I know the military pays me into my USIA checking, but that's not, the percent interest on that is extremely low. And just moving the money around a little bit to sit in different places could be making me more money than I am. I also really enjoyed how you went into depth about the bank, how the bank makes money, lending money to people, and how you can very easily do that as well. I'm trying to remember what else. I have it on my iPad and I just made a bunch of notes digitally.
Well, that's
good. Those are the big ones that stood out to me.
Okay. Yeah. And I think, you know, if I just want to like add a couple, you know, comments for the audience on the discussion with the high yield savings account and what we're talking about, which is, you know, when you put your money in like a checking account or savings account with Navy Fed or USAA or, you know, my personal bank is Chase, none of these banks give me any sort of kickback. So I'm not endorsing any of them. But I imagine you had USAA because that was, you had to open an account with them to get the career starter loan.
Yeah.
So
exactly.
There's some. And there's some other benefits, especially in the military with USAA and Navy Fed, that all you got to do is watch like college football or NFL and you'll see the commercials and they tell you all the advantages. But they're still only paying you like 0.5% interest on your money.
Mm-hmm.
And inflation is right now, it's, you know, hovering around 3%, which means you're actually, the value of your savings is dropping. You know, if you have $100 today, because of 3% inflation, by the end of the year, it's only going to be worth $97, even if it still says 100. And so there's these things called high yield savings accounts that pay sort of like what the T-bill or the treasury rate is, about 4.5% right now. And so you can move your money into there and the 4.5% return will help you keep up with inflation. You'll maintain the purchasing power of your savings. And what we say here, you know, with the military wealth coach is we recommend that anything that you're anticipating is like a major purchase in the next 5 years, thereabouts, like that money should go into a high yield savings account. And the reason is that one, we just covered like the interest is good and it keeps you ahead of inflation. But a lot of people end up, if they either have their savings or they have the money in like an investment account and they buy stocks, and then 5 years goes by and they decide they're ready to buy a house and they sell, let's say, $50,000 worth of stock. And of that, $20,000 was an investment return. And now they have to pay capital gains tax. And they lost that investment as a way to continue growing, earning returns and building more wealth. And so the high yield savings account is this great sort of, the term I like to call it, like within our personal finances, is a war chest, because like we put the cash in there, it grows with a high interest rate, and then we use it to make an investment or a big purchase, and then we just refill, you know, like stock back up the war chest. And so I think what you're saying is you've had this savings sitting in a regular savings account, and you, because you want to stay liquid so that you can make purchases, you don't want to just go buy a bunch of stocks and make it complicated. And so your option is going to be to move it into a high yield savings account. I just want to ask, so is of all the things I said, is that because you want it to be available for things in the next few years, or is it just for your emergency savings?
Yes. Yes to both. Still want it to be liquid. Don't want it to be stashed away and not able to use it at all. I recall the term war chest that you had used, and I really liked that. And then I just need to flowchart it better and figure out, well, where do I want that to be? Where do I want that to reside? The other fun fact I remember reading from your book that was definitely mind-blowing was that the Department of Defense will advertise like, oh, yes, we're increasing the pay for service members. And it's like, it's actually lower than the inflation. So actually you did not get a raise. You're actually getting paid less now. So running the numbers and looking at the numbers on that was actually pretty, pretty mind-blowing. So yeah, your book was full of a lot of great information. Unfortunately, being back from ship for only a week, I'm still very much sifting through a lot of the notes that I made on ship there.
It's like time stands still when you're on the ship and like you can't get online and you get back and you're like, oh,
just
overload with everything.
Yeah.
You know, not just like things you want to do, but things you have to do, or like nagging emails from like your grandma. No, I'm not saying grandmas are naggy, but every Monday, it seems like I sit down, I'm like, okay, I'm going to do X, Y, and Z today, and I'm going to spend 2 hours writing. And then all of a sudden it's like 3 in the afternoon, AKA 1500. And all I've been doing is like answering emails and paying bills, you know? So,
yeah, no. And
go ahead and please.
To your point there, like you said, with the time management, a point that you had in your book as well is the money management. Like if you're not deliberate with it, you can very easily become like an O3, a captain in the military, and you're living paycheck to paycheck because you don't take the time at the beginning to cut out, I'm going to save X amount of money. So that was another point I remember reading from the book that's like very true, because I see even a lot of my friends as lieutenants living paycheck to paycheck, and it's just astounding that they don't take the amount of time, very little amount of time that it would take just to cut out, I'm going to save this amount just for me. So just like you said with allocating time, like money is the same way. You have to do it. You have to cut it out first for yourself. That way the rest of it doesn't get, it can very easily slip away. To your point, I think you had mentioned at one point you were a major and you and your wife sat down, you're like, well, how do all of our paychecks keep disappearing?
Yeah. Fortunately, I was still just a captain.
I wasn't
too far gone at that point, but it was,
I've only known you as a major. So I assume all majors are majors for about 20 years.
Yeah. I can probably feel that way. Well, so it sounds like, you know, for the, you and I both have like the same reaction. We're like, how could you not see this? But, you have seen it. So do you want to tell us a little bit about the process you went through? Like, you knew you were going to start getting paid. You had goals. You had things you wanted to achieve. Like, kind of talk to us a little bit about how you set those goals, like how you prioritized them, how you, you know, if you did, like how you came up with a number, like what that dollar figure was that you had to save to get there, et cetera.
Yeah. So definitely right as soon as I joined, somebody had thankfully told me about the TSP. And I feel like a lot of people, unfortunately, are among us in the ranks and just have no idea it even exists because it's not very well advertised. But definitely put the 5% to fire and forget on that to at least match what the military is going to pay on that one.
Yeah, also free money, right?
Yes, exactly. But I also I went ahead and opened a Roth outside of that, and we just looked at the annual maximum contributions, divided that by 12, and then at the beginning of every month, or if I want to pay it for 2 months at once, just contributing that to make sure I hit the maximum to contribute for the year. That's financial advice that I've sort of gotten from generations above myself, sort of now in a position where I'm wondering, can that money be growing faster somewhere else if that's money I'm not going to be seeing until I'm 65 and retired? But I've continued to hit the I believe on that one and put away the monthly allocation to hit the annual max out on a Roth outside of the TSP. So that's my monthly like chop, and that's going to save just for me. And then the rest of the months, if I can put some away for my individual brokerage account, that's more of like not what I have left over, more so like this month, can I do $100, $200, or $300 for that? So that's usually those are my two big, make those savings from the paycheck early on in the month. That's money that's put away for myself that I'm never going to see again, or at least leave it alone to grow.
Yeah.
Those are the big ones. Yeah, I will see it again. But to me, it's non-existent. It just goes away immediately before I have time to spend it on things like cycling or motorcycling or... Yeah.
Well, it's a good attitude to have, right? Is, you know, there are easy ways to still go back and get that money. And, you know, one of the advertising or selling points that people say like, oh, Roth, you know, do the Roth IRA because you can pull back your contributions anytime you want, you know, like that's an advantage of the Roth, take your contributions back. Well, if you do that, you're not going to get the benefit. The returns, right? So your attitude backing up the discipline to save, but your attitude is also saying like, I can't touch this even if I know legally I could.
Yeah.
Is really important.
Yeah.
So So as if I understand it correctly, you're contributing to the TSP at about 5%. And then you're also, I think the current for 2025, I think the annual maximum contribution for somebody under age 50 is 7,000 for an IRA.
Okay. I can't fact check you on that. I'm just putting away still 600 a month. That must be up because last I recall it was like 5,000, 6,000. If it's 7, I'm going to have to readjust. Been 2 months off ship, so I just have it to an automatic payment every month. And then log in and check on it every once in a while. But yeah, to your point, maybe I need to adjust that if they've upped the maximum.
Well, I know I'm right that it's 7,000.
Oh,
if you're
okay.
Doing 600 a month, that's 7,200. So
there you go. Yeah. Like I said, I have it set to to auto pay and it's like it doesn't exist to me. So it gets taken away before I even spend it and then have it allocated to invest.
So I'm dying to know why you're splitting those contributions between the TSP and an IRA.
Yeah. So maybe fortunately or unfortunately, and I appreciate the terminology you've used to allude the beginning of my career, but I am over halfway through. I decided recently I'm going to be getting out with my end of service date assigned after the academy. So 2027 is when my EAS is.
Okay.
So I think I had a sneaky suspicion for a while that the TSP wasn't going to be my end all be all. And I'm aware that the TSP is only, and in fact, this answers one of your questions that I saw on your list later is like, I don't know what the options are for the TSP after I'm not a service member. So I have the 5% and I could be doing more, but I'm not because the majority of my savings, to answer your question, you're dying to know, I'm pouring more savings into a civilian saving more than a military. So only doing the TSP 5% because it's like you said, free money and why would you not? But a lot of my friends that already see themselves as 20-year career military are definitely putting a little bit more into the TSP to grow that egg. But that's why I did both so that I could have options later. And now I'm sort of leaning towards not using the TSP so much. But I think in one of your questions, you said, what's something that you don't have a lot of education about that you could perhaps talk about in a later podcast? Or if you have the answer right now, I would also be dying to know. I don't really know what happens to the TSP once service members step away from the service. And so that's why I've only been doing the 5%, because I don't really know what my options are to do with that after I'm no longer in.
Okay, let's talk about it. You ready?
Yes.
Okay, so the TSP, basically, you have a vesting period, and you are well into that. So, you know, I believe it's 2 years. So, like, on the first day of the 25th month of your time in service, you're fully vested. If before that you are separated from the service for any reason, you're not going to get to keep the matching funds that go into it. But
okay.
Your money that went into it will always be yours. Okay. So, and the TSP, the only thing that happens when you leave the service is you lose the ability to contribute to it because the TSP is a 401k for federal government employees, which means it's sponsored by your employer, which means you have to be employed by them to contribute to it.
Gotcha.
So essentially, the reason why this is important is that when, for all the people, like you've probably seen some in your career already, like separated, you know, NJP'd and then court-martialed or whatever, like they're separated for medical reasons less than 2 years in. All of those like 5% matching that went into their traditional TSP from the government, it gets distributed to everybody else who made it past 2 years. So bad for them, a little bit better for you. But you've made it past that 24 months in a day, and so you're fully vested. So you're entitled when you get out, all the money you contributed, all the investment returns on it, all of the matching funds and all the investment returns on the matching funds, they're all yours to keep. You just can't make any more contributions. And then what you can do is, well, sorry, there's one other thing that turns off to you before you separate. 401ks and the TSP and other employer-sponsored retirement plans allow you to take loans against them, using them as collateral of up to half of the balance or $50,000. So if you have $100,000 in there, a month before you EAS in 2027, you could take a loan for $50,000 and use that to go buy a house, another house. Your TSP of $100,000 will stay invested and continue to grow. And so when you pay that loan back over 5 years, Well, now you still have, you know, now you got $150,000 in the TSP, right? Whatever. Right. So a couple of the, you know, a couple of the decisions that you have to make before you get out are, you know, are, do you want to take a loan against it? You can't take a loan against an IRA. And then you also want to just kind of decide, like, if you're going to keep it in there or if you're going to roll out or convert it into another fund. And it has to be another retirement plan. So if you were to get out and you were to go work for, you know, PricewaterhouseCoopers or something, right? And they have a 401k, you could take the money in the TSP and you could pull it out of there and you could throw it in the 401k. No taxes, no penalties, right? Because you're going from one retirement account to another. If you draw it down to zero, if you take it all out from the TSP, then like your account's closed forever.
Okay.
But if you leave at least like $100 in the TSP, your account stays open and you can actually go the other way in the future. So you can't contribute to the TSP after you get out, but as long as you have $100 in there, it's open. You could convert or roll over money from other retirement accounts into the TSP.
Uh-huh.
And the reason why you might want to do that is because the TSP has lower funds and fees than most mutual funds that other retirement plans have. And I know it's a long answer, but as an example, you know, like the C fund or the S fund, I don't really recommend any of the other funds that the TSP has, but, you know, their fee structure is something like 0.05% or 0.07%. My wife recently, well, not recently now, it's been a while, but she took a contracting position with a DoD contractor and they were like, here's your 401k plan, pick a fund. And their version of the C fund, the fee was 2.5%. So it was like 500 times more expensive. If she had a TSP account that was still open, she could make her contributions into that new 401k and then she could roll them over back into the TSP so she would get her C fund at super cheap. So my recommendation to anybody who's asking for it with the TSP who's going to separate is make a decision really fast. Well, like in the last, before you get your last 90 days, if you need to take a loan against it and then keep it open, keep money in there.
Yeah.
Keep it as an option. And so that way you can do that. Useful? Is that good?
Yeah. Yeah. No, it makes more sense than what I've been able to find online. So I appreciate that. Thank you.
Well, I want to, at the risk of taking over this segment of the show, I want to add one more thing that I think is super valuable for anyone in uniform, but especially those who are either A, deployed, or B, getting close to getting out of the service, to consider is the Roth IRA is its value comes in more than just what you can contribute into it. And the reason I say that is because your TSP matching funds that you get with the blended retirement system, they're all going into the traditional TSP, which means those are before tax dollars. And that means that 50 years from now, if you want to take it out for retirement income, you would have to pay tax on it. What you can do is you can convert those and you can move them from your traditional TSP and put them in your Roth IRA. And you can do that right now. And you should do a little bit each year because you will have to claim it and you could have to pay some taxes on it depending on your tax bracket and certain situation. But it's a lot better to each year convert $3,000 or $4,000 from the traditional TSP into your Roth IRA than it is to wait 50 years and now you've got $500,000 in there and it's going to cost you $200,000 in taxes, right? So not just before you get out, but every year, what you could do is you could look at whatever's in that traditional TSP from the matching contributions and you can, all on the TSP website, you can go in and you can request a rollover and you can convert it to Roth funds. So kudos on you for having it. If you hadn't done that before, please take a look at it and just you don't have to do it all at once. You can just do whatever makes sense so you don't get whacked by taxes.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I'm definitely going to have to dig into that a little more. Very unfortunately, I've actually been locked out of my TSP because I got a different phone number coming overseas. So when I go to log in right now, they send a confirmation code to a number that's only going to work once I'm back in the States. So I have to get on that one once I get back. But that should be within the next 30 days. And I really appreciate everything you've mentioned here. I'll definitely be referring back to it when it's time to tackle those.
We should probably make like a 3 or 5 minute YouTube video just showing the click sequence.
That would actually be,
click here,
yeah,
click here,
I would love
click
that
here,
and
here.
I would show that to all my friends as well.
All right. Well, now I put the pressure on. I gotta figure out a way to do it. It's actually a lot less daunting than a video podcast because you can just do screen capture and then like nobody has to look at you.
Talk over it.
Yeah, but okay, that's so I should write that down. It's really a great question to ask because, as you said, the generations that come before us, you know, I can attest to it. Well, at the Naval Academy, I got in plenty of debates with like 05s and 06s who were like telling everybody like open a Roth IRA and contribute. And I was like, well, are you maxing out your annual TSP contribution? And they're like, no, I'm only putting like 500 in there. I was like, well, then put more in that, you know? Absolutely need a Roth IRA so that you can do those kind of conversions and take advantage of it. Before I forget, there was one question because you like what you brought up, like really valuable. I'm glad we talked about it. You mentioned a couple times the emergency savings. And I just wanted to, before I forgot, ask you if you have like a certain number for that amount of savings that you are at or trying to reach. And like, if so, like how you came up with that number.
Yeah. So I use maybe controversial here, but I have just the Amex high yield savings. So that's super liquid to me. And I can access it anytime I need to. The rate I have on that with 5,000 sitting in there, I believe is 3.5 or 3.7. They advertise it as like 4.5 or 4.8, but that's if you have like $500 in it. And then as you put more money into it, they actually adjust the rate that they'll give you. But to me, 5,000,
it goes down.
Yeah. At least it has for me. I've had some funny story with Amex, like they offer you a huge referral bonus to your friends, but I think they take that away once you refer to a certain number of people, because I had it offered and I was referring a bunch of my midshipman friends and getting a bunch of points. And then one day it wasn't there anymore. And I was asking my friends and I'm like, do you guys have a referral bonus or is that seasonal right now? And they open up their app and they're like, no, I have it. And I'm like, I don't. And I called them and I was like, I was wondering if this is like seasonal or if it's for the user. And they're like, yeah, it's for the user. So it's not being offered to you. And I think it's because I used it too much. Like I would get a bunch of points just from my friends. But anyways,
did you get to use the points at least?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I use the points. I think it's like 60,000 points for referring somebody. So I'm a huge proponent of like if you're a responsible credit card user, the military perks that come with the American Express are definitely not something to ignore. But I have 5,000 in there because my car is a 2008, and when she has issues, they cost a little bit, but I don't want the emergency fund to be completely gone. So I've paid, I think a total of $3,000 to $4,000 in car repairs or car maintenance or things that I need to keep the car up and running. That was part of the reason I got the motorcycle. I was like, if the car clunks out, I'm not about to do a brand new car or even shop around for a used car right now. Like I didn't even want to entertain it. So I wanted to learn how to ride a motorcycle and have that as a means of transportation, because my car was only $10,000. If it were like, if the transmission were to go out, there's no way I would pour $5,000 into it. But $5,000 is the amount that I keep for like, yeah, if it needed a $2,000 repair, that's something I wanted to have on hand. So 5,000, sort of just arbitrary number. That's sort of the limit that I would pour money into repairing that car. I would not put $5,000 into it. That's like the maximum. But yeah, if I had a $2,000 repair, yeah, that's something I wanted to have on hand have emergency funds for other things.
Right. And you know, you said like, I think you said random or arbitrary, you know, like the dollar amount. And yeah, it kind of is. But the way that you came up with it is still really practical, right? You're like, I have these possible expenses that I don't want to put on a credit card or like have it like derail my life. So I need that much cash. And that's exactly what you should do, right?
Yeah.
I'm sure you've heard like the 3 month rule or 3 months of salary or 6 months of salary. Are you familiar with that?
Yeah. Yeah. I think you talked about that one in your book as well.
And if you were following that, just ballpark, you don't have to be exact, but like ballpark, how much would you have had to save up for your emergency savings if you were following that?
That's like a paycheck and a half or like a month's worth. Just about. A BAH gets a little tricky because BAH in California is like stupid high. But salary based, that's like two paychecks or a whole month's worth. But to your point, I don't see myself being unemployed for 3 months straight. So I think my emergency funds will go up higher when I'm not in a job that I like. Yes, I could get laid off, but that's not something that's going to happen in the military right now. So for that reason, I don't have savings that high in the emergency fund itself. But yeah, definitely a good rule of thumb. And the emergency fund probably would be a little bit higher when I'm not employed by the Department of Defense.
Yeah, I agree with that. And like, I would definitely encourage you when you're, say, like 6 months out or maybe like the final year to start bumping that up just to give yourself, most people, they like are going to panic if they don't have a job lined up day one. You probably won't be in that position, but I feel like you could put yourself in the position where you're like, not only do I not need to stress about that for day one, but I'm going to give myself the gift of like a month long trip to Indonesia to go snorkeling, you know, and like rock climbing. Like, you know, you could just do something radical when you get out instead of like sloughing off to the next job and what most people do, right?
So yeah.
No, that's a great place to be in. You know, you're right. We had shared a whole bunch of questions, and I want to make sure that they're not all skipped over, because I think the way the conversation's gone today and the things that you've shared have been incredibly valuable, and I'm glad we just kind of like had a conversation, right? That's the whole point.
Yeah.
And trying to like steer things where they want, you know, going back, and I think we can tie it in here with the emergency savings, for example, is how did you fund that? And did any of it come from the career starter loan that you got when you were still at the academy? If it didn't, what did you end up doing with that career starter loan that you got?
Yeah.
So kind of like a 2.5 part question.
Yeah. The career starter loan definitely funded some of that. I think before I took the career starter loan, what I considered an emergency savings when I was a midshipman roaming the halls of Bancroft was like $500. Like,
yeah.
There was nothing in my life that I would have had to have paid that would be over $500, which is like crazy looking back, but that's such a sheltered environment. So that's what the emergency fund was there. And then as I accumulated these things, like a car, a house, a motorcycle, it needed to be upped a little bit more. Yeah, that definitely came from a career starter loan, definitely kickstarted money in my bank account. I remember when it hit and I saw $30,000 in my account. And I was like, whoa, that's crazy. But I was semi-responsible with it. So what I used it for, to your point earlier, I did use it for a trip. I took the basket leave once I graduated, and I went to Italy and I went cycling in the Dolomites. So that was awesome.
Oh, wow.
Lost about $5,000, maybe slightly under, because I did an all-inclusive trip with Trek Travel. So they paid for food, hotel, bike. All I had to do was get there, which I actually got for free by one leg. I took a Space A to Germany. I did a build-your-own adventure to make my way over to Italy. So that was quite the experience. I would highly recommend Space A to any service members. It was definitely a risk I took, though, because I had to pay up front for the trip. So I had this like $4,000 trip lined up. I just had to get there. And I decided to take the gamble like a week out. I hadn't bought any tickets yet. I knew I could afford a ticket if I needed to, but it would get more and more expensive as I got closer. But I took the gamble and did a Space A, showed up and was able to get on a C-17 and make my way over to Germany. Like on our layover in, I think it like went to Texas to pick up some parts. And I was like, oh, okay, if I land in Germany, like when's my next flight? Where, how am I going to get there? So like that was really quite the adventure, taking trains in Germany to get to the next airport and then getting myself over to Italy, since the military didn't fly me to Italy, but they did get me halfway across the globe. So just being thrifty there, but definitely treated myself with the basket leave and did a trip to Italy. What else? I bought the car. I think I referenced that was okay. Paid in cash. Also did some negotiating there. The sponsor program at the academy, I was close with a family that lived out in town. He was a midshipman, and so he really came full circle. He was an O5 teaching at the academy, and he was a mentor of mine. He helped me go shop for cars because, unfortunately, in today's day and age, if a 18-year-old woman, or I guess I was 21 at the time, shows up to a car dealership trying to buy a car, you could get schemed out of large amounts of money. So he popped the hood and looked at the car. We took it for a test drive. He knows cars. He was like, yeah, if you can get this for like $10,000, that's pretty good. It was a 2000 Toyota Highlander. This was right before the microchip shortage, when the market kind of went south. So I like to think I got a good deal. The car is still running. Like I said, it's got some issues, but she does what I need her to do. But got it for $10,000 at the academy, paid that in cash. The cash gave me negotiating power as well. Again, not physical cash. I had to write a check for that one, but had the money from the career starter loan. So that was huge. What else did I do with the loan? I also took a trip to Singapore with some friends. One of my friends grew up in Singapore. But really, all I had to do was pay for the airfare to get there, which was a good chunk of change. I think $1,500 round trip to get from Annapolis to Singapore. But he grew up there. So really, it was like having a trip like with a tour guide. Like, I didn't think at all. He just told me what flights to buy. And then I went with him. And that was probably one of the best memories of my spring break. That was when COVID happened. So that was quite the experience being overseas.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Told not to come back to school, but I wouldn't trade that trip for anything, and still talk to all those people to this day that I went on that trip with. So used money for that. And then for junior officers, you have to buy a good amount of uniforms. For midshipmen, we wear fake uniforms that they don't, they're not existent in the Navy. It's like, yeah, we just around on campus wearing our own little uniforms, self-declared uniforms. So you have to buy Marine Corps uniforms, which I did. The Marine Corps has like two vendors, the Marine Corps Exchange and then the Marine Shop, both of which I was like not super happy hearing the amounts of money I was going to have to pay. I think the Marine Shop specifically, and hopefully there's Marines listening to this, so I'm not just rambling, but I think the Marine Shop will try to scheme you out. And they're like, yeah, if you pay $3,000, you get all these fancy bells and whistles, like a wooden box to keep all your trinkets in for all your uniforms. Yeah, you definitely need it. And I'm like, do I really need that? I'll move to Quantico. I don't want that. And so I talked to my company senior enlisted leader, who was a gunnery sergeant. I think she's a master sergeant now, Master in Vallejo. And she was like, ma'am, I keep all my stuff in a tackle box my entire career.
That's right.
Like 100%. You don't need a wooden fancy, like, don't buy that. And I was like, all right. And so that's what I do. Like, I have a tackle box in my closet. It has all my stuff in there. And it's so convenient. Like, you have way more little pockets and stuff. So I say that because when you have the money, it's like, yeah, I can afford that. But it's like, do I need that? So I was really skeptical about the Marine Shop trying to sell me all that. I did not buy with them. I bought with the Marine Exchange, the MCX, who is also located at every single base Marines would ever go to. So it just made more sense to me. And I actually went home and thrifted uniforms from Marine Corps Recruit Depot, San Diego. When recruits drop out of boot camp, their MARPATs have been worn like once or twice, and you can buy them for like $20 a pop at the Marine Corps Recruit Depot, San Diego. So I went shopping there one weekend when I was home on leave. And they'll try to sell you those for like $60 a piece, top and bottom. But when I went home, I grew up around Marines, so I knew where to go and how to shop now. So got some of my stuff for a lot cheaper than they were trying to sell me. They'll try to sell you those $3,000 packages with everything you need. But I remember going thrifting and getting things for way cheaper that looked brand new and still serve me to this day. So midshipmen will drop a large portion of money on uniforms. So travel and uniforms and a car were my big ones. The other self-indulgence I did was a brand new bicycle, because the amount of hours I spent sitting on a bike. I had a $200 used Trek was my very first bike, and I rode that for about 2.5 years, but I was pretty serious about cycling and really, really enjoyed it. So I pulled the trigger and bought a brand new Canyon, and that's actually still the bike that I use. So my $2,000 from the career starter loan there has served me well and continues to.
Yeah. And, you know, $2,000 for a bike is a great deal. I'm not sure how many people listening can actually relate to that, but
yeah,
you know, somebody might be like, that's a wasteful purchase. And I'm like, that's
great,
not a waste.
But it is a little outdated. And I bought the bike. So opposite of the car, I bought the bike during COVID and the market was rough. I wanted a bike with disc brakes. I wanted a bike with DI2 electronic shifting, but they were all sold out because everyone decided to be a cyclist during COVID. So the bike I wanted was a little more expensive, but I couldn't get my hands on the size, but I needed the bike for the sport. So I ended up getting something a little bit cheaper, but I still am self-conscious about when I pull up to races or group rides and I still have rim brakes and everybody else has the disc brakes nowadays. So that's going to be my next big purchase, but the bike still rides. And for the amount of riding I do, it's definitely served me $2,000 worth.
Well, the one thing that I think you should never feel guilty about with brakes is you shouldn't be using them anyway.
Exactly. Yeah.
Brakes are for stopping if you really need to stop. And if you're in a race.
Yeah. Awesome. I'll just take them off actually.
Yeah, right. That will intimidate the competition. Well, so, you know, as I kind of reflect on all the things that you've talked about in today's conversation and I line up, I'm like, okay, you know, this is a person who, you know, when she's in high school, she's very motivated and driven, and she did what she needed to do to reach her goals. Then she didn't take on debt early. She didn't have a car. She went to the Naval Academy. So there are certainly some decisions that you made either strategically or just because it felt right at the time that have put you in a great position because you don't have student loan debt. You don't have like an expensive auto loan that you're dealing with. And then along the way, you know, and really honestly, in just like three years, basically, you know, you've become a homeowner, a real estate investor. Picked up some really good hobbies. You've done some really fun trips. You've got an emergency savings fund. You are saving for retirement. So you've got a decent little nest egg growing there. You've got your own brokerage going. So you have some other investments that are not in retirement so that, you know, 10, 15, 20 years from now, those could really come in handy. You're kind of like moving ahead in all of these different ways to make yourself in the future set up for success. And at the same time, you're living a really good life and doing the things that make you happy, pursuing the hobbies that, you know, they cost a little bit of money, but you're able to afford the now and the later. Do you find like when you compare yourself to people around you, like, how do you feel? Are you like struggling? Are you denying yourself things? Or like, or do you feel like you're kind of in a better situation? Like, how do you feel you're doing right now?
Yeah, I went to coffee with a lieutenant and a captain the other day, and one of them had mentioned student loans. And I just forget that almost every single other lieutenant that I'm around has some form of debt. So it makes me pretty sad to hear, because it's a lot of money, like you had mentioned before, a lot of money on interest there. And that's something that people carry with them for a long time. My aunt is a physician's assistant, and I mean, I'm not going to ask her right now, like, are you still paying student loan? But I know people in the medical field, and they live a life of service too. But to get that specialized schooling, oftentimes people take on large amounts of debt. And it's just not something that exists in my brain. Like, yeah, there's no stress of like, my debt is like self-induced for a home, not so much like going to school because it was something that I was fed knowledge like, oh, yeah, you should go to college and get a degree. Like, It is quite a weird feeling to have a 4-year degree and not have any debt for it, because in America today, those usually do come with debt. So it's something that I just don't think about at all. And when I hear people talk about it, I'm like, oh, yeah, I forgot. Most people like have that just looming over their head, which is really unfortunate, because the money you make can't really pay that off at a fast enough rate, and that interest just increases. I can't relate, and it makes me feel bad, because I'm like, oh, I got a degree without paying for it. I just pay in suffering of 4 years being locked on a little campus instead.
Yeah, I'm like debating every day. I'm like want to steer my daughter towards a service academy. You know, so I'm like, whether you know this or not, I made my last payment on my student loans in May of 23. So,
oh wow,
you were already a commissioned officer.
Yeah,
I was still at the academy. And I had about 5 years of payments left, and I was just like, screw it. And I sent him a check for like $45,000.
Yeah.
I was like, get me out of here.
Yeah, just be done with it.
But it hurt. And that was 20 years later.
Yeah, I bet. Man. Yeah, so I just can't relate.
Yeah, which is a good thing. You don't want to relate to that. When you look back at it, at the purchases and you know, investments and decisions you made with your money up to this point, which is still like pretty early in the game, are there any things that you kind of like regret doing or that you wish you had done?
Yeah. So I wrote this down because it came to me, and I was like, I really struggled with what was going to be my answer to that one. Don't remember what number. I have like a bunch of notes here. Oh, yeah. No, I do have a very embarrassing purchase that was like a large amount of money that I probably shouldn't have spent. So when I got a townhome, 2-bed, 2-bath, weird setup. It's got a very open concept kitchen, and I had this space. Like, the downstairs is literally just an island, L-shaped kitchen, and then a large space. And what a normal person would do is get a couch and a TV. But I don't watch TV. Like, I don't pay for subscriptions. Mm-hmm. My time at home is very limited as is. So if I'm on a couch, I'm going to fall asleep. So I've never owned a couch. What I decided to do with the space, and I had this idea in my head for a long time, I was like, you know what? I want to get a pool table. Like, I love playing pool. Like, what if I get a pool table? I've been saying it for a long time. I moved into the house in like December of 2013. 3, I think it would have been. Yeah. And then the space just stayed open for so long because moving into a house and starting a new job and stuff, like, it was just boxes on the floor for a while. Finally got blinds installed in the house. The space just stayed empty for so long, like a fold up table from Costco and like bills and stuff. The space was empty for a long time. And I would have people come over and they'd bully me and they'd be like, why don't you have a couch and a TV? And I would explain, like, I don't want a couch or a TV. Like, I'm not going to use either of those two things. And I was like, I really want to get a pool table, actually. And I had been saying it for so long. And one time one of my friends was like, why didn't you get a pool table yet? And I was like, you know what? I'm going to get one right now. And so I like pulled my phone out and I ordered it. Again, I had like talked to somebody, said like, when can you bring it and install it? And a pool table is not something that like you need somebody to install it. That's not something you can like pick up and move. Like they're very heavy.
Right.
So I had to have the guy and his team, great guy, come and install it. But it cost me like $500, $700. I don't remember. It was a nice table and I used it a ton. But unfortunately, I bought it like unbeknownst to me. I bought it like 2 months before I was going to deploy. So I had awesome pool table at my house. And then I found out I was deploying. Like I found out I was going to be a platoon commander and deploy. And I was like, well, I think I'm going to move out of my house then. And then I was like, oh my gosh, I have a pool table. Like I can't move that. I have to pay somebody to move it now too. So I had an awesome party though. Like I invited all my friends for a pre-deployment party. And I think the silver lining in this was I got really good at pool and then the party was awesome. Like everybody loved the pool table. They're like, why do you have a pool table? And I'm like, because I wanted one. I don't have a couch. I don't have a TV, but I have a pool table. And some of my friends actually have met each other and since become friends because of this party I had. It's a very poor financial decision, but my friends like have become friends with each other. And I'm really excited to get back to California and just hang out with some of my friends that are now friends with each other because of the party and the pool table. But yeah, that was a poor financial decision because I didn't know I was about to deploy. And then I ended up having to pay. Like, I couldn't move it myself. I don't have a truck to move it. And you can't, like, pick it up. You had to disassemble it to get it through the door in my house. So I called back the same guy, like, 3 months later. And I was like, could you help me move it? And it cost, like, $300. So I poured almost $1,000 into having a pool table. Where is it now? It's at one of my friend's houses because I had to move so quickly. I went out to 29 Palms for 2 months. And then when I came back, I was like, I have to get it out of the house if I'm going to rent the house. And I'm like, who wants a pool table? And Lieutenant Manchin was like, we have an extra room, but we have nothing in there and it can fit a pool table. So they have it. Hopefully they've been having fun with it. But that's Oh, yeah. But now I have to pay to move it to wherever I move to next. Or it's just indefinitely like sitting in their house and like I'm going to be down more money to either get rid of it or have somebody that wants to buy it and then move it to them. But yeah, that was a poor financial decision and it's going to cost me upwards of $1,000 by the time I do whatever I'm going to do with it.
Well, you know, it's looking back at it, like obviously it feels a little painful right now, especially because you didn't get to enjoy it. But
exactly.
At least you weren't doing things like taking your career starter loan and like buying meme coins and like, you know, and then it goes to zero and you're like, oh, that would be bad. So I feel like in the scheme of things, you probably got off pretty well.
Yeah, makes for a good story, but the pool table does exist still. So can I get a couple hundred out of it, selling it back to somebody? Maybe. It is Southern California, but it is still at my friend's house.
Right. You just have to hope the condition you get it back in is still like playable.
Exactly. Yeah.
With that, do you have anything that you like wish you had done or maybe in a better, you know, kind of going for the opposite trend of that first question, is there anything that you wish you would known that you know now? You know, if you could like quickly travel back in time to commissioning, you know, back at the academy 3 years ago and say like, hey, make sure you do this or make sure you check out this. Advice for your younger self.
Yeah. So going back to our TSP conversation earlier, actually, I didn't change the funds until actually right before I deployed because I was looking into like long term, where should money be sitting? And then I researched and surfaced that there are better funds in the TSP than just the automatic one that it'll pour you into, I think is the L fund. And then, like you said, the C and the S funds. But I think people don't even know that because they contribute and they just assume that it's one fund in there. But to anybody about to graduate and open their TSP, just log into it and change the funds because the C and the S, I agree with you. And that's what my internet research had yielded as well. I didn't do that until about a year ago. So that was 2 years of it just sitting in whatever the automatic one is. So definitely do that as soon as you commission. That was the big one that I was just like, nobody told me and I didn't figure it out for myself. So if anybody's in that position, just don't assume, just log into things and check them. Don't be afraid to ask people. Same thing with I wish I would have known. The Academy actually did a decent job teaching this to us because we had leave and earning statements as midshipmen's. So I was like comfortable interpreting it. And granted, there was like next to no payments on them, but we still had LESs and we could look at them because I think a lot of officers and definitely enlisted people right now have no idea how to read and interpret them. So as an officer, it's your job to make sure other people know how to do that. And to make sure they know how to do that, you have to know how to do that. If you don't know, just don't be afraid to ask. Like, usually the adjutant in a unit is really good at that. Or if you work with a financial management officer at any of the MLGs or wherever else they stick them, they're definitely the wizards in that realm. So yeah, don't be afraid to ask. And it's better to like stick your nose into something and realize you don't know much about it than to just ignore it and hope that it's going well, like the TSB.
Yeah, that last statement is just blanket like awesome advice is don't ignore it. Don't pretend it'll just take care of itself or get better. Yeah. You know, you have to be actively involved in all this and be, you don't have to know everything, but you got to know enough to keep yourself out of trouble.
Yeah. I think a lot of people are just scared of realizing they don't know something. So they just avoid it. And that's definitely been an experience I've had with owning a house too. Like sifting through mail and it's like, is this legitimate mail or is this somebody trying to get me to refinance with them? So I can't just ignore it and throw it away. Like, is this an actual tax for San Diego County or is this like you got to deep dive into those things. And I think a lot of people are just afraid. So they ignore, but like you have to immerse yourself and yes, it'll be uncomfortable and you'll probably realize you don't know things. At least that's been my experience with like paying a mortgage, but the first step to learning is like realizing you don't know.
Yeah, that's true. You know, and that is definitely sort of one of the inspirations to like this whole project with the Military Wealth Coach is like a lot of people, I think, as you're saying, like at the start, they kind of like run into these roadblocks and they're either going to put their head down and ignore it or they're going to charge ahead and kind of like hope they can figure it out because there's not a lot of great resources for learning about it. And so I thought, you know, let's take like, you know, at this point, like 20 plus years of accumulated knowledge and just like dump it all out there. Yeah. And I chuckled when you talked about the LES statements in the class because I can still picture the training that we got at Officer Candidate School, at the basic school, in the fleet. And it would be like a 42 slide PowerPoint where they like went through each and every box of that LES. And yeah. I didn't finish this because I started it right around Christmas time and then the holidays got involved. But I was like, I'm going to make the simplest and best way to understand the LES. And it's literally you just like redact like 90% of it. And you're like, look in this box, look in this box and look in this box. The only three things you need to know, right? Like, yeah. How much leave do I have? Did I get paid my money? And how much tax is it? You know, like, and you're set.
Yeah.
Right. So Maybe that's something that another idea for a, it's probably a little longer than a YouTube short, but you know, you could probably go in like 5 minute, you know, just a YouTube class and be like, look here, look here, look here. And that's all you need to do.
Definitely.
I'm curious. So we've kind of, you know, covered some of the things that you wish you would have known and, you know, and some advice that you'd share when you look ahead to the next couple years, the last couple years that you plan to be in service, and even beyond that. Are there any things that you see as kind of looming or questions that, you know, you already asked the question about like what happens at the TSP when I get out, but, you know, it's kind of like a never ending adventure and plan that you've got to put together and journey you've got to go on. So like, as you're looking ahead now, what are the kind of things that you're thinking about or worried about?
Yeah. So something I'm worried about after a lot of my deep dives in LESs is like I pay out my ass for state taxes in California and it's just because that's where I'm born. And so I envy people that their home of record hasn't always will be Texas. It's like they're not paying a fraction of what I pay. And it's just wild to me because we are lieutenants that do the same exact job, except I have to pay a large sum of money every single month to the state of California. So unfortunately, I was not a pilot and I did not go down to Florida and I did not have the opportunity to change my residency to a state like Florida. But to anybody that does have the opportunity to live somewhere while they're in definitely change your residency for while you're serving. You're going to be saving yourself a lot of money from right off the bat, just wherever your residency is declared. So I never, looking back, I never had the opportunity, and there was no way I could have. Like, Maryland wouldn't have been any better. I did the math on that one when I was a mid. And then I only went to Virginia for TBS. You can't declare residency there. I mean, I don't have a property. I was just there for 6-8 months. And then my MOS school was in North Carolina. Same thing. I'm living in a barracks room. And then I'm back to being a station in California. Like, I'm paying what I should be, I suppose. It's where I'm from. It's where I live. I'm paying California state tax. But I'm just envious of anybody that had the opportunity to declare somewhere else. So that's sort of looming over my head. It's like, well, I'm going to PCA probably and stay in California. But then when I get out and I'm paying normal people taxes, like where, like I could move somewhere and use the VA potentially again and buy a residence somewhere else, maybe. So like, do I want to use the VA loan again? Like, how can I use it one more time potentially? Where do I want to use it one more time? If I do use it one more time and I want to shift residency, then my California property would be an investment property out of state for wherever else I declare residency. And then another looming question, do I even want to stay in the United States? Like, what would it look like to travel, live abroad? What would that mean for my property that I'm having in California still? Do I want to keep that property in California? So those are sort of the questions floating around my head that are just, I still have some time to figure them out, just under 2 years. But the idea of paying taxes in California for my forever is like not ideal.
Yeah.
It's definitely something I like want to get away from, but you know, I do call California my forever home. Like, my dad is going to be living in Southern California for the rest of his life. Like, San Diego is his home. So it will be my home base that I come back to. It's just a matter of, do I want to have residency declared and continue to be a California state taxpayer?
Right, right. These are big, I mean, these are big questions, and they are bigger in some states than others that you, as you bring up with California. This is not off the top of my head. I don't remember all three, but I was doing this kind of like research on like tax arbitrage, like where you can live, because the first university I went to was the University of Oregon. And a bunch of the kids who went there had parents who worked in Portland, which is kind of like a, it's not a huge tech center, but they all lived in Washington across the river. Mm-hmm. And they did that because there was, they didn't have to report like income tax in Washington. And then Oregon, there's no state sales tax.
Yeah.
So they lived in Washington, did all their shopping in Oregon. And then you can do the same thing if you like live in Wyoming and don't pay income tax. And then you shop in Montana where there's no sales tax. And then there's like one other state, it's like Pennsylvania and Delaware or something like that. And then there's one other hack. And I only heard this on a podcast. So don't just run off and do this. Anybody who's listening, make sure you do the research. But as I understand it, South Dakota has no state income tax, and your requirements to establish residency are a mailing address and one day per year being physically present. And so in this podcast, these are some real estate investors, like Airbnb investors. They're like, we actually live in South Dakota. We have an RV, and one day a year, we drive up there, we park our RV, we get our mail from the post office, and that keeps us as residents. And now we pay no state income tax. So I don't know if that's true. I don't know if it's true, but I mean, if this is like a serious thing, like you should definitely do some digging. And, you know, there's Washington, Wyoming, those are some pretty beautiful states. Maybe there are also not a lot of people there. So maybe we'll help like get a wave of veterans moving to Washington and Wyoming.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
And then, so there, what was, you talked about state tax concern, talked about where you're going to end up, like overseas.
Yeah, like and potentially living abroad.
Was there was one other, I thought you had three. Sorry.
There may have been another one. I'm considering going back to school as well. I didn't mention that, but toying with the idea of getting an MBA, but that would cost a lot of money. And I think I would take on some student debt for that. Decisions, but.
Lots of things to get excited for, to plan for. What do you, as sort of like a final question to that before we wrap things up here, now that you've made the decision that you're, I guess, about 24 months out, maybe a little less from leaving the service and making this career and life change, are you updating anything on your financial plan and your savings or accounts or anything like that? Or if not now, when do you think that you'll start sort of like preparing financially for this change?
Yeah. So just, I suppose, more aggressive savings, because like you had mentioned before, you want to have some larger emergency funds so that you can live without having a paying job to rely on if need be. I haven't made any explicit changes quite yet. Yeah, that 20 months will fly by if I let it. But I have like, I would say three service members ahead of me that have already made the transition out. So just picking their brains about what that looks like financially and making notes to myself. That's been valuable already, and I assume will continue to be, but no massive changes yet, just more aggressive savings. I had mentioned it before, but yeah, someone's living in my house right now, so I have a problem to solve when I get back. That'll be pretty soon here, within a month. I don't have anything lined up, but I'm wrangling the idea of potentially renting somewhere out and asking the owner if I can sublease. So, like, if I get a two-bedroom place, like, is it okay if I sublease to somebody else? That way, I'm still saving a fraction of my BAH. Also, just getting creative with, like, how long could I get away with, like, couch surfing? I built up the back of my car to a camper a couple weeks before, or maybe it was a couple months before deploying. So, in the back of my car, I have gone camping for, like, three days at a time. It's not developed very well. It's just like 2x4s and plywood right now, but it's like, it's a bed and it fits me and my bike, and it's pretty awesome to just be able to drive somewhere. The radius you can get away in California can get you to some pretty incredible national parks. So I'm like, do I want to be paying for a place to live that's going to be extremely expensive when I plan to be gone on the weekends? I pulled the trigger on an Icon Pass. I fell in love with skiing last season, so I fully intend to be pretty far away from Camp Pendleton most weekends when I get back. So just a lot of ideas in my mind about, like, how can I continue to save so that I have a large nest egg saved for when I do get out.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's the time of your life right now when you can do that. And if you got to, you know, to use a rock climber's term, like dirt bagging it, you know, being nomadic and bouncing around, you know, when I listen to you talk about it, I'm like, that sounds awesome, right? Like, just forget about this big house and all the junk in it for a while and the bills, and like go travel and adventure and take advantage, right? And so, you know, and worst case scenario, like, you could just convert that pool table into like a little bit of a, you know, like a bed.
Exactly. No, I was thinking, like, well, it would actually be a great, like on Airbnb, I'm pretty sure they have like hot tub, pool table as like standalone entertainment items. So I'm like, well, if I could rent a place from an owner and then they give me the permission to sublease it, I can have it listed, and then I can, hey, I got a booking. I'm going to leave for the weekend. Somebody's going to live here and use my pool table and the hot tub I just bought because they want to. And I'm making money and I'm going to be away anyways. So that's an idea. It's in my brain right now. No action on it yet, but we'll see. We'll see what that yields.
Well, I love it. You got a great entrepreneurial spirit. You know, I think just your brain naturally is a problem solver, as you kind of said before, and all that lends itself to having a lot of success, right? And I would definitely characterize your story and your financial situation right now as successful, because you're preparing for the future and you're still doing some really fun things and right now, and you're enjoying your hobbies, you're enjoying your friends, you're getting around and traveling, and it's hard to ask for much more out of life, in my opinion, right? Because once you go beyond that, you're probably just wasting and throwing away the money off of stuff that you don't need and you won't remember.
Yeah, no, I 100% agree to all of that. And the added bonus for me, and I'm really thankful for this, is my family is in Southern California. So I'll probably make it back to Camp Pendleton in time to take my little brother to the Miramar Air Show. And it's just like life could not be better. So yeah, just awesome.
That's great to hear. Yeah, well, I'm super excited to hear all this and get the deep dive updates and everything. And, you know, it's not just because, you know, we go back and we've known each other for a few years, but it's because you're a young officer who's thriving and growing and doing great things. And, you know, part of being in the military family is you always wish success for all those who come after you. And, you know, it's never like, oh, darn, they're doing better than I did. You're like, yes, you know, keep going and keep charging. So that's great. I want to congratulate you on all you've accomplished, and I hope you feel proud about it. Before wrap things up, do you have any saved rounds or alibis, to use one of our favorite Marine Corps
not
aphorisms?
Saved rounds. Yeah, like you said, I know you had a bunch of talking points or a conversation definitely flowed really well, but I think all the big ones I wanted to talk about, we actually ended up talking about. I'm just looking over a couple of my notes pages. I don't think I have anything groundbreaking to add. Yeah.
Okay. Well, then, is there anything that you'd like to, final thoughts then, if there are no specific talking points, any kind of final thoughts that you want to get out there?
I think my final talking point, which I didn't say explicitly, but my lifestyle may has already alluded to, is I think money is really just the currency that we trade our time with in today's day and age. A lot of the time I like minimalistic mindset and just money. I don't think twice when it's spent on an experience, with whether that be with friends or family, an experience or a hobby, traveling or for sport. So that's really where I don't think twice about spending money. If it's going to be an experience, if it's going to be making a memory, going out to eat with people, I will never say no to that. And it's really quite the blessing that money is not anymore something that will turn me away from hobbies or time with people I want to spend with.
Well, thank you for that. And it's lucky that we agree on that. You know, money is just how we trade our time to get the things that we want. And when you know the things that you want, you have those kind of values set in place and goals that you're working for and the things you know that you want, you're much more likely to be in a good financial situation and not just be kind of like chasing whatever you see on social media or your friends have. Or, you know, it's so easy to get caught up in the peer pressure, you know, the classic keeping up with the Joneses type, you know, situation. I always laugh because like we have friends who are the Joneses and they like have lots of stuff. And like, I'm like, I didn't really mean you. And you're almost coming back to the States. So your adventure in the Western Pacific's winding down. And I would say that, you know, I think we have a really good opportunity to potentially do like kind of like a little panel or like a future episode where we have maybe two or three folks and you know, maybe some of the folks we know from the cycling team at the academy who are also 2, 3, 4 years into their career or something like that. So if you'd be interested in putting together, you know, kind of like a round table or a forum type podcast in the future, we'd love to kind of like do another episode in that format if you're interested. So
yeah, definitely. It's cool. crazy that some of the people that were on the team with us is like, they just have children now. So I'm in such a different place, and I see memes about it online too. It's like parents taking pictures of their children, and it's like me taking pictures of my motorcycles.
Yeah, yeah.
Definitely different stages in life for some of us, but yeah, the finance, that definitely bleeds over to the financial sector as well.
Yeah, it could be good. So let's stay in touch with that. And when you get back to the States and you're back ashore, if you have any questions about like the navigating the TSP or any of the stuff we talked about, just like send me a text or an email and, you know, we can jump on a call or whatever. If there's anything you think I can do to assist, just reach out.
Definitely. I will definitely take you up on that. So thank you. I appreciate it.
All right. Well, hey, this has been an awesome conversation, a great interview. Again, really blessed to have had Lieutenant Anna Saucedo here on the show, you know, personally just getting to catch up, but then hearing about all the great things she's doing out there. And for anybody who doubts or hates on a military paycheck and what you could possibly do or the cost of living and all that stuff, you know, Anna's a great testament and example that we can all follow on how you can prepare for the future and still be, you know, liquid enough and have the cash available to pursue your hobbies and passions and have fun in the here and now. You know, it's not an all or nothing thing. And that's a message that we're always trying to get across. So Anna, thank you so much for your time. Thanks so much for your comments and your insights and sharing about your personal and your financial life. You know, it's not always that easy to like open the book, and we really enjoyed having you. We wish you the best of luck. And to everybody else, you know, if you found some value in this episode, I'm sure you did, please share it with at least one other person who you think would also enjoy it and learn something from it. And we'll just continue to grow this community. And we'll see you again next week. All right.
Awesome. Thank you.
We did.
Thank you for spending time with me today. I know how busy life is in and around the military, and I don't take your attention or your time for granted. It really means a lot to me that you're here. And that's why I pour so much of myself into each episode to make sure it's worth your time. If today's episode helped you, here's your challenge. Share it with a battle buddy, friend, partner, or someone in your family who could use this information. Together, we're growing a stronger, smarter, and wealthier military community. For more resources, tools, or to sign up for a free coaching session, head over to www.military.com. www.militarywealthcoach.com. And you can also find us on LinkedIn and Facebook by just searching for Military Wealth Coach. Follow us on Instagram and X at MWC112358. Our groundbreaking book, Service and Wealth, 12 Proven Money Habits to Master Military Finance, has just been revised and expanded for 2025, and it's available in paperback and Kindle on Amazon right now. And stay tuned for our next book, The Ultimate Military Retirement Plan, your standard operating procedure to financial freedom. Hey, until next time, stay financially fit and mission ready.